Welcome. Welcome. Welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 73.
And if you haven't melted from earlier this week, welcome.
Welcome.
So yeah, it was hot as balls this week.
Mm-hmm.
Really fucking sucked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I survived the 2 days at work, what it was, because by the time I came home, it was like heat index of 105.
My car was reading 99 degrees air temperature.
And the local airport, where the weatherman that works out there, he said they like tied a record of like 96 degrees. So hopefully
they beat it. 97.
Oh, they did? Mm-hmm. Last I seen it was 96.
They said it on the news.
Oh. So hopefully you guys haven't melted into a puddle, because I sure as hell almost did.
Yeah.
But anyhow, what do you have for this week? Oh, wait, that's right. It's my episode this week.
It's a David-sode.
It's a David-sode. Yay!
Yay! Would have been the best time for that button.
The Kermit button?
No.
Oh.
The button where they're cheering and clapping?
Oh, yeah. That's on a different number pad now. So I have some kind of a history true crime thing about hijacking airplanes in the golden age of flight. That's what I have this week.
Okay.
So for on this day, August 28th, country singer Shania Twain was born on this day in 1965 in Windsor, Ontario. Best known for the songs "You're Still the One," "That Don't Impress Me Much," "Man, I Feel Like a Woman," or "Man, I Feel Like a Woman." Anyway.
Oh, my God.
Matt Vogue made his debut as the voice of Kermit the Frog in a video named Muppet Thought of the Week in 2017. Vogue also did the voice acting for Big Bird, The Count, Mr. Johnson, and many other characters on Sesame Street. Mr. Johnson is the bald blue guy.
Okay, I was going to say, I don't remember Mr. Johnson.
I had to look that one up because I was like, I'm not wondering, because I was like, when I read the name, I was like, I'm not wondering if it's that guy that I just mentioned. And sure enough, it fucking was. I don't know how I put two and two together.
My brain would have been like, was he pink and veiny?
No, not that kind of Mr. Johnson. John Denver's first hit, Take Me Home Country Roads, peaks at number 2 on the Hot 100 in 1971 on this day. A 1952 Mickey Mantle baseball card sells for $12.6 million at auction, becoming the world's most expensive piece of sports memorabilia in 2022. I didn't bother inflating it because it's so close.
There was a thing on the news yesterday, I want to say, that one of Babe Ruth's like original shirts that he wore when he was playing baseball just sold for like $24 million or something like that.
Well, now you just made that like.
But that was for 2022, so that's still. And this was just announced yesterday, so.
In 1830, the first American-built steam locomotive, Tom Thumb, raced a horse-drawn cart from Stockton and Stokes Stagecoach Company from Baltimore, Maryland to Ellicott Mills. And the horse won due to the locomotive having mechanical issues.
I mean, it can happen.
And our death that we normally end this with, mm-hmm. I debated on putting this in, but I still felt it was very historically significant to put this in.
Okay.
Emmett Till's life was cut short on this day when he was murdered in 1955. His death was one of the major events that sparked the civil rights movement. He would be 83 today if he was still alive in 2024.
Damn. 83.
Mm-hmm. But that's our on this day for August 28th.
Yay.
Well, huh. Yay, minus that last one.
Well, yeah, minus Clearly. The last one.
But are you ready to get started then?
Yes, are well, you?
I am. So let's get started.
Okay.
It's hard to remember there was a time when airports had no security. It's even harder to imagine when it was normal for your plane to be hijacked, as most people who flew basically expected it. Between 1968 and 1974, over 240 planes were commandeered or attempted to be taken over. It wasn't until 1974 when the U.S. government passed the Anti-Hijacking Act, requiring passengers and carry-ons to be screened before boarding, that it finally ended. About, you know, expecting a plane to be hijacked.
Yeah. Well, people expected it?
Yeah, because it was such a frequent thing in this time period.
Ugh, okay.
So why were these hijackings going on, and why were most of these airplanes headed towards Cuba? Plane hijacking in the 1960s and 1970s involved mostly men with political or financial agendas using guns, knives, bombs to get whatever they wanted.
I mean, that's pretty much...
Right. Like, one of these people that comes to mind would be, like, D.B. Cooper, but, you know, that was in the Pacific Northwest when that happened. Right. It was so common that the public had become desensitized to the situation and didn't even bat an eye anymore. Sadly, we can kind of relate to that almost to mass shootings and school shootings, unfortunately, in this day and age, because it's so frequent.
Yeah. And there's a lot that we don't even hear of.
Right. Once the host of Candid Camera was on a flight that was hijacked and the passengers all assumed they were on the TV show, the phrase "Take me to Cuba" became a running joke on flights. Because of how frequent this was a thing going on.
Jesus.
It all started with a hijacking on May 1st, 1961, when Antulio Ramirez Ortez entered the cockpit of a National Airlines flight and overpowered the pilots. He had a gun and a knife and demanded they go to Cuba instead of Key West, Florida, which was their original destination. He claimed that he was a Fidel Castro loyalist who had left Cuba looking for work, but now there was an assassination plot against Castro and he needed to go home to warn him. When the plane landed in Cuba, surprisingly, Castro returned the plane and all the passengers and the crew within one day. Ortez stayed in Cuba.
Okay.
I know, it seems a little bit weird that Fidel Castro would return a plane like that. But, you know, those people, the people and the plane, they, had nothing to do with his agenda. It's like,
right. Just get and nobody out of here. Got hurt, right?
Nope.
Okay.
Ortez should have been happy with his getaway, but of course, he was an idiot. 2 years later, he tried to leave again, was arrested several times, and eventually sentenced to 3 years in prison for espionage in 1965. When he got out of prison, he tried to leave again several times over and spent another 3 years in prison for espionage in the early 1970s. He finally left Cuba in 1975, only to be arrested upon arrival in the United States for the hijacking in 1961. He spent 4 years in prison in the U.S. for this hijacking. At the time of the first hijacking, the U.S. had no policies regarding air piracy and no laws against it. Ortiz had been charged with assault and transporting a stolen aircraft across state lines. I would really think this would probably more be international lines because he's probably the flight started in one place, was supposed to end in Florida, so that's where the state lines comes in. But after, you know, Florida, that's when it becomes an international crime and Interpol probably would be involved technically, but I didn't think to look to see if Interpol is a thing yet.
Yeah.
But anyhow...
Back in the 60s?
Yeah. I don't know.
I feel like it was.
Maybe that's an episode we should look into. What? An origins episode for me. What caused the creation of Interpol? Like, what international incident caused that to be a thing?
That could be interesting. I'll have
to put it on my list when, you know, once we get out of the Emporium for the day.
Yeah.
Most flights that were commandeered went straight to Cuba. Castro was welcoming the hijackers in order to humiliate the U.S., and he found a way to profit from it by demanding the U.S. pay $7,500 to have each plane returned. People who were brave enough to hijack believed that Cuba was a place that they would be greeted warmly and taken in. In a few hours, it would have been dawn in a new world. I was about to enter paradise, one skyjacker recalled. In a few hours, it would be dawn in a new world. I was about to enter paradise. One skyjacker recalled thinking as the runway lights at Jose Marti International Airport came into view. Cuba was creating a true democracy, a place where everyone was equal, where violence against black injustice and racism were things of the past. I had come to Cuba to feel freedom at least once. In reality, Castro hated the hijackers and thought they were undesirable malcontents. Once they landed, they were shuttled off to headquarters of G2 Cuba's secret police.
Secret police?
Yep. We kind of learned about secret police in the Third Wave episode.
Kind of.
They would be interrogated for weeks, accused of working for the CIA. Eventually, when released, they were sent to live at Casa de Transitos, hijacker's house is what it translates into. It was a shitty dormitory in southern Havana. They were given only 16 square feet of living space and about 40 pesos a month to survive.
That's not a lot.
No, considering the inflation rate between that and the U.S. dollar, probably not the best. There's a lot of inflation stuff I forgot to do for this episode.
Oh, my.
We're going to blame it on the heat.
The heat.
It melted my brain a little bit and forgot the, hey, here's a dollar amount. You need to, like, convert this so everybody can understand normally. Yep, I dropped the ball on this one, everybody. My bad.
Way to go.
Everyone had their reasons for leaving, though. One 34-year-old Cuban forced a flight back home because he missed his mother's frijoles. A student from Kalamazoo, Michigan, hijacked a plane to go to Havana so he could study communism firsthand.
The fuck?
Yeah, I don't get it. Yeah, it's like, unless it was like he was starting to suffer from seasonal depression or something. Like, I'm going to Cuba where it's fucking warm. That's probably not the case. That's what I'm just saying. For years, the government had stepped in and airlines were concerned that putting up metal detectors or adding more security would be off-putting to passengers and cause a decline in flights. More off-putting than a hijacking of an airplane? Okay.
Apparently.
Sure, you know, let's not fast forward 20, 30 years into the future, you know, late 2001.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually, though, the government could no longer ignore the situation. They began to meet to discuss solutions to try and stop these hijackings.
Mm-hmm.
In 1968, a Senate heard took place at the FAA, which is, you know, the Federal Aviation Administration, if I remember correctly, that's the acronym, was represented by a functionary named Irving Rip. His testimony made it seem like the FAA was hopeless, stating it was impossible. It's an impossible problem short of searching every passenger. If you got a man aboard that wants to go to Havana and he's got a gun, that's all he needs.
Mm-hmm.
Different solutions were proposed. One thing that they did build was a fake replica of the Havana airport in the United States for hijacked planes to land in. Senator George Smathers of Florida brought up the idea of using metal detectors and x-ray machines to screen passengers. The technology had been stating to be used at maximum security prisons and facilities, so it was not too much of an outlandish idea. Mm-hmm. Just imagine being one of these hijackers, and he's like, oh, we're in Havana already, and then it's just like fake guards, but they're really white guys trying to act, you know, they're from Cuba, and it's just like, wait a minute, like the Kazoo Kid would say. Something
doesn't belong.
Be like the Kazoo Kid, wait a minute, who are you? Or something like that.
Fucking Kazoo Kid, oh my God.
I don't know, don't ask me why he just popped in my head talking about this.
Because it's fun. Fuck my life.
Rip dismissed the idea, saying it would have had a bad physiological effect on passengers. It would scare the pants off people. Plus, people would complain about invasion of privacy. Skip forward.
Wait. Having yourself and your luggage scanned would scare the pants off people.
Mm-hmm.
But you were totally okay getting on an airplane knowing that more than likely it's going to be hijacked.
Right.
Fucking white people.
Sadly, yes, but anyway. No one rebutted this, and the hearing ended without any type of solution. 2 weeks later, a Delta Airlines flight was hijacked, and one of the men on the plane happened to be Senator James Eastland of Mississippi. After this incident, hijackings were starting to be taken more seriously. National public figure being put at the risk, they realized it was a big deal. Of course, leave it to the government to wait until one of their own is in trouble or to actually take something serious. Of course. It's just like the customers we deal with, you know, with what I do. I'm like, hey, this is a problem. And then nothing happens. A customer calls and complains about it one time and it gets changed immediately. Like, really? I warned you guys about this a year and a half ago. It's going to be a problem. And they're like, you don't know what you're talking about. Okay. Yeah, I'm only your instructions for like everything. But anyway, that's a whole other rant we don't need to go on tonight.
Nope.
Not in a public forum, at least.
No.
Almost immediately, the State Department proposed a novel anti-skyjacking solution. Free one-way flights to Cuba for anyone who wished to go, provided they vowed to never return to the United States. But Castro refused to accept these good riddance flights, as they were called, in his words. He had no incentive to help America curtail its skyjackings because he found it humiliating to the United States when these happened. Airlines were unwilling to spend the money to be able to find passengers with hijacking intentions, so instead they focused on how to keep hijacking safe. I know. I know. Every airline adopted policies that basically called for everyone to just be compliant with hijackers to avoid any violence or death. Any acts of heroism were strictly forbidden. So no John Wicking on an airplane in the 60s and 70s, basically.
We're just supposed to shut up and take it?
Pretty much.
That will never be me.
To facilitate impromptu journeys to Cuba, all cockpits were equipped with charts of the Caribbean Sea, regardless of flight's intended destination. Pilots were briefed on landing procedures for Jose Marte International Airport and issued phrase cards to help them communicate with Spanish-speaking hijackers.
Hola, no el shooty, por favor.
My God. Air traffic controllers in Miami were also given a dedicated phone line for reaching the Cuban counterparts so they could pass along word of incoming flights.
I don't even know what to say.
I know. It's been a while since I've had one of these around here. Switzerland's embassy in Havana, which handled American diplomatic interests in Cuba, created a formal letter that airlines could use to request the expedited return of stolen planes. By the 1970s, hijackers realized they could demand things over than just going to Cuba. They started asking for ransoms, since the airline policies were to comply with anything. They again would comply. Obviously, when people heard of the airline's compliance, it made more people come forward looking for money or even gold bars. So I've not seen Sarah's face like this in a long time on any story I've given
her. I'm stuck on stupid, apparently, just like these people were.
While they practiced complete compliance, the FAA did create a task force to deal with the problem. John Daly, not the same one of Comedy Central. A task force member who also served as the FAA chief psychologist began to attack the problem by analyzing the methods of past skyjackers. He went back as far as 1961, with the first hijacking created a database. This helped to create the first profile of a hijacker, and while they all looked different, they all had a common behavior problem. A common behavior pattern. I don't know why the fuck it turned...
What's that?
I don't know why... Well, my problem is, why did it turn pattern into problem? But anyway...
Obviously, it's a behavior problem, too, so we'll just take it.
He created a list to help identify potential hijackers, including things like paying for a ticket by unconventional means, not maintaining eye contact, and expressing an inadequate level of knowledge or concern about their luggage. Luggage. I somehow took luggage and language and tried to make them into the same fucking word.
Luggage. I love it.
It's just... a big suitcase is shaped like a word. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's carried by the Scoopy ghost device of Halloween past.
Scoopy! God, I miss Scoopy. Okay.
He thought if that they could weed out these people, they could then be pulled aside and checked with a metal detector away from the general public's eye. In late 1969, his method was tested. During the experiment, his profile selected only 1,268 out of 226,000 passengers. Those beckoned aside for a brief date with a metal detector. 24 were arrested on weapons or narcotics charges, and most important to the FAA, the passengers pulled aside did not mind the extra scrutiny. Most that were asked after said they were happy something was finally being done to prevent hijackings. Never mind, you just got caught with, like, you know, 4 kilos of Satan's booger sugar, you know, or whatever, or the devil's dandruff. But, oh, thank God you guys are doing something about all these skyjackings. Can't get my nose candy back to Cuba this way.
True.
Actually, probably, no. Yeah, it'd still be the... So I can't get my nose candy to Miami. Thank God you guys are doing something about hot... No, it's like...
Well, yeah, because boats are a thing, and Cuba's not that far
right from
Florida, so...
When the hijacking started turning toward monetary items in the 1970s, airlines would voluntarily use John Daly's new system. They posted flyers that warned passengers of the use of metal detectors. Janitorial crews started finding guns and weapon stashes and plants in garbage cans, and it was assumed it was because people chickened out when they saw these warnings. Could you imagine now who live somewhat in a world like this now. Uh-huh. And some kid found a gun inside of a fucking planer just hanging out in the airport because of this.
It would, that whole area would come to a standstill.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying, you know, if we lived in a world where 9/11 didn't happen and airport security is locked down now, it is because of that. If it was still just as laxed as this, because I know you, we grew up in that world before that all happened, so we remember how fast and loose, lack of a better term, airports were, you know. Yeah. But if it were still like that and a gun, a kid found a gun in a planter like that.
Slow and tight.
You know, this day and age. Yeah. But yeah, but to find the kid, to find a gun now in an airport like that now, yeah, it'd be locked down pretty damn fast. Yeah. Even though the system was helping, there were still flaws. The pilots and stewardess were not informed on which passengers had been cleared with a screening, so when someone claimed to have weapons, they did not know if it was a possibility or if they were bluffing. So they erred on the side of caution and still complied with demands. Also, another giant flaw in the system was that depending on the airline's ticket agent, not a security force. You know, people how are once policies in place for a while and just easy to skip out on and get lazy, and it was not guaranteed that they did a thorough job. It's like, yeah, they look fine. It's whatever. Fuck it, it's Friday. You're good. Just go through, basically. You know, D.B. Cooper could be considered, you know, fall under the Big Six rule, but, you know, he famously hijacked a plane and demanded a ransom. And after the money was delivered with several parachutes, he did jump from a plane and he was never seen again. Just, you know, quick and short about him if you don't know who he is. Yeah. There's enough other podcasts out there that have done stories on D.B. Cooper. We're not covering him.
Kid Rock covered him also.
What?
Kid Rock.
Covered D.B. Cooper. The fuck are you talking
about? It's a line in one of his songs.
You're really going on with that?
Yep.
As much as you dislike that guy, I am surprised you brought him up.
I do.
Don't let her fool you. She's a huge Kid Rock fan.
No. Like, no, she is not.
Oh, she is. Don't worry. Just like having an extra hole in the head, basically.
I mean, I'd take more of those, but I won't take any Kid Rock in my ear holes. All
right. Hijackings were getting really intense by 1971. Some were dangerous. Some were so dangerous. Threats such as a hijacking where three criminals demanded $10 million and threatened to crash into a nuclear plant if they weren't awarded the money. Another hijacking threatened the White House, but he made a mistake on calling the pilot before they took off, so he was caught before the plane even left the ground. And on January 5th, 1973, all passengers are now being screened. And all passengers had to pass through metal detectors, and the FAA instituted universal physical screenings. Although these searches caused delays in boarding, the public was pretty welcome by this point. Whereas today, people complain about all the screening processing. Obviously, more hijackings would happen. This, you know, the hijackings of 9/11 probably being the last huge takeover of an aircraft, but it became very few and far between after the Anti-Hijack Act of 1974 was in place. Over time, airports got more proficient and safer, eventually implementing the X-ray machines that were first suggested back in 1968.
Yeah.
Now, carry-ons are more limited. Screening processes are more in-depth, especially for those without a government-issue ID. Liquids are now regulated. You have to remove your shoes at check-in and top it off of screens having to be conducted by federal employees, the TSA, part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which was created in 2001 in response to the 9/11 attacks. So basically, if they're, like I said about the kid and the gun and the planter now, if that was found now, the TSA really fucked up.
Right.
So if you fly...
Just the way you said that, like, that sounds like the title of a book. The Kid, the Gun, and the Planner.
The Kid, and the Gun, and the Planner. Coming this fall on NBC.
The Kid, the Gun, and the Planner.
Or something like that. Coming soon to Netflix. The Kid, the Gun, and the Planner.
Yes.
I don't know. But anyway.
Sorry.
If you fly these days, it's obvious that the airport takes security very seriously these days in their post-9/11 world, as they say a lot. Yeah. It's also almost impossible to believe there was a golden age of hijacking, but it is pretty fun to remember and talk about.
That's it.
That's all I got this week.
I don't know that it's fun to talk about. Like, that was just pure stupidity.
Right. I mean, like I said before, we look at what's considered our past now and we're like, what the fuck? I mean, all sorts of goofy shit or goofy or not, like Kentucky Meat Shower comes to mind talking about that. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
All the Victorian stuff we talked about and stuff, you know, and
fair.
And eventually, you know, people are going to look back in our time about stuff and be like, what the fuck? I mean, like they're going to look back at COVID, you know, the COVID years and whatnot. And you're going to be like, oh my God, what the fuck? Cause you know, when they do that by now, I mean, hopefully modern medicine happens to be like in science fiction, basically, you know.
What else would they look back on in 50, 60 years about what's going on, like, right now?
The internet currently at this time, probably TikTok comes to mind.
Yeah, the fashion trends.
Yeah, I mean, that's always one thing. Because we look at swimsuits in the early 1900s and be like, oh my God, you know.
Yeah. Huh. Makes you wonder.
Probably how the internet was. And it was like, oh my God, they only got that many gigabytes a second.
Yeah.
They're going to probably be like terabytes a second by the in 50, 60 years, whatever, or whatever is beyond a terabyte.
Yeah.
But, you know, let us know in the Facebook group what you guys think they were going to look back at in the future.
Yeah. What's going to make them cringe in 50, 60 years about today's world?
Yep. Oh, and one more thing, I guess, basically. So with, like, our last episode, the 1904 Marathon Olympics, the weather the last 2 days, basically what those guys had to run in.
Yuck.
To give you guys an idea how terrible the conditions were running for them.
And they were running in just regular-ass pants.
Well, only one guy was.
Wow.
Well, he's allegedly dead. But, yeah.
Like well, I said, thank you.
Let us know in the Facebook group what you guys think are gonna, you know, 50, 60 years from now, what they think they're going to look back on us and be like, oh my God, what the hell? Or if you're on Spotify, leave it on a comment on there too.
Hey, there you go. Do that.
Yeah.
Do that thing.
So, I don't got anything else. What about you?
I got nothing.
I don't either. So I guess it's time we get out of the Emporium for the day, Sarah. What do you think?
I will say that this was a good one because shocked me stupid, I guess.
Wow, I haven't done that in a while. When was the last time I done that on an episode?
I feel like it was the Greensboro sit-ins.
Oh, the Greensboro 4?
Yeah.
Well, it shocked you stupid?
I think you just shocked me mad with that one.
No, I shocked you mad with that one, obviously, but stupid with something like history-based like this, you know.
I don't know. Common sense isn't common, people.
Right.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right. So, and until next time.
Remember to creep it real.
All right, bye.
Bye. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on TikTok at Macabre Emporium Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. If you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would like us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. And remember to follow, rate, review, and share whenever and wherever you can to help us grow our podcast.